Well, thank you for coming. I believe we'll get started and welcome. I'm Randy Chestnut. I teach on the faculty here in religion and teach in New Testament. And our topic today is self-denial, as you know from the program. And in the same line that's often been quoted this week and will be quoted, where Jesus calls upon people to take up a cross and follow him, he says in that connection, and even before saying that, deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. And so that's the part of that that we want to focus on today. It will be primarily in the form of a study of a particular text, or cluster of texts, actually, in the Gospel of Mark. So I invite your attention to the Gospel of Mark. In fact, I want to begin by reading a text from Mark chapter 8. And we'll be primarily in this middle section of the Gospel of Mark today. So Mark 8:22 and following. They came to Bethsaida. Some people brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, and when he had put saliva on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Can you see anything?" And the man looked up and said, "I can see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he looked intently, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. That is an unusual passage for several reasons. In the first place, it's the only story of Jesus, miracle story of Jesus, in which a healing doesn't take place immediately, but takes place in stages. Jesus touches the man, and he can see, but he can't see clearly. And Jesus takes a second run at it before the blind man can see clearly. And then there's the strange matter, which I won't really deal with today, of spitting and putting saliva on the man's eyes. Spitting was considered defiling in the Jewish culture of the time. And as far as I know, considered pretty disgusting in every culture, except baseball, where, of course, it's expected. But whatever we make of those odd features, we can say for sure that this story serves to introduce a long section in the rest of Mark chapter 8 and all of chapter 9 and all of chapter 10, in which Jesus interacts with his 12 disciples about their own distorted vision. The section is, in fact, bracketed by two stories of the healing of a blind person. This is the first one, and the other one is at the end of that block of material, at the end of chapter 10. The only two stories in the Gospel of Mark, in fact, about the healing of a blind person, and therefore positioned where they are, no doubt, to bracket the intervening material and suggest an interpretive framework for them. In other words, to suggest that this intervening material between these two stories of the healing of a blind person is really about the disciples' lack of perception, their blindness, their eye disease, their blurred perception of Jesus and what it means to follow him. Blindness is often used in the Old Testament that way as a metaphor for ignorance or lack of understanding. It's used that way a number of times in Isaiah, for example. Plato, the great Greek philosopher, did the same, as did Philo, the Jewish philosopher and biblical interpreter who lived in Alexandria down in Egypt, roughly a contemporary of Jesus, who almost consistently, when he uses the term blindness, is not talking about literal blindness, but talking about failure to perceive truth, moral truth, philosophical truth, religious truth. And that's the way that it is used in this larger context here, though, of course, he's dealing with literal blindness in the particular episode that we just read. This man is a living illustration of the spiritual condition of the disciples. To this man, people looked like trees walking around. He could see, but he couldn't see clearly. And the disciples' vision in this story was equally distorted. And so they needed further help from Jesus to open their eyes, just as this man did. And in fact, as Jesus touched this man's eyes a second time, he offers eye-opening instructions for the disciples as well in this context, in the form of three blocks of material in which Jesus, first of all, anticipates his death. And then the disciples show lack of understanding of that and lack of understanding of what it means to follow him. And then, thirdly, Jesus clarifies the nature of his own ministry and mission and something about what it means to follow him. In the first of these three, in chapter 8, Peter had just confessed Jesus as the Messiah. That comes in chapter 8, verse 29. He had correctly confessed him as the Christ. "You are the Messiah, the Christ," Peter says in 8:29. And that's correct. And yet, immediately following that, Jesus rebukes him for that confession and says, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on divine things, but on human things." Indicating that he was not confessing Jesus on his own terms, but on Peter's own terms. And so, Jesus then moves in 8:34 and 35 from his own ministry to those who would follow him and what that entails. And he says, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it." And then in chapter 9, in round 2, we have the same pattern again. Jesus predicts his impending death. And the disciples, soon after that, get in an argument about which one of them is the greatest. And Jesus responds, this is 9:35, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." And finally then, in the third round, in chapter 10, after a third passion prediction, James and John come to Jesus, supposing that a little of the glory that they've just seen in the great transfiguration episode might reflect onto them if they play it just right. So they ask for positions of status in Jesus' coming kingdom. And that then makes the other 10 apparently jealous that they didn't think of it first. And so to James and John and the others, Jesus says, and this is 10:42, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Now the question that that repeated cycle raises for us is, how could the disciples have been so blind? How could they have been with Jesus day in, day out, heard him talking about the kingdom of God, heard him talk about the values of the kingdom, seen him live a life that was not one that was asserting his own will, but elevating God's will above his own, a life of serving rather than being served? How could they spend time with him and hear that and see that and yet be so blatantly self-serving, thinking first and foremost of their own interests, and even arguing about which one of them is the greatest, and jockeying for position and power and notoriety in his kingdom, and even recasting Jesus in their own image? Well, maybe because they just weren't very bright. That is true in Mark's portrayal. In addition to the critique, Jesus' critique of these disciples that we've already read, look at the passage right before the one in Mark 8:22 that I just read, where he asked them this barrage of questions. They have seen the 5,000 fed. They have seen the 4,000 fed. And yet, they're whining that they have no bread. And Jesus says, "Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? Do you not remember?" And a couple of verses later, "Do you not yet understand?" These people were not the sharpest knives in the drawer. But a more fundamental explanation for their lack of perception, and a more disturbing one, is that maybe they're too much like we tend to be. That is, self-centered, and self-seeking, and self-serving, self-interested, self-absorbed, self-gratifying, self-promoting. Their eye disease, in other words, EYE disease, was basically eye disease, the letter I. An affliction that is still very much with us. When I, some months ago, gave a subtitle to this topic, I called it Self-Denial in the Me Generation, and I realized later that that's probably not a very good one, because that may imply something that I don't mean to, and that is that the current generation, that is, after my generation, has gone downhill and is more of a me generation than my own generation was, and I don't think that's the case. I'm a member of the boomer generation. I'm a card-carrying member of the boomer generation. I'm reminded of that fact all the time now, because I turned 65 very... Well, it's none of your business when I turned 65, but anyway, I've started to get a lot of information from the government about certain things that I need to apply for within the next 2 months. And in the boomer generation, my success is judged by how much power and influence I can get, how much wealth I can accumulate, how much critical acclaim I can command by my personal achievements, how much I can win. It's all about me, my success, my achievement, my comfort, me. Now, if the analysts are right, subsequent generations, Generation X and Generation Y and the Millennial Generation and the Mosaics and whatever other labels are now used, are more civic-minded and service-oriented than that, and that's good to know. But in some ways, I'm afraid that self is still right at the center. I'm afraid that many of us across these generations have taken Mr. Rogers too seriously and think of ourselves as so special, so personally and individually special, that the whole world revolves around us. Other people need to adapt to my needs, my preferences, my expectations, whether in the family or in the workplace or even in the church. It's all about me. But that's not just a generational thing. Remember the ancient Greek character, mythical character, Narcissus, who fell in love with his own image that he saw reflected in a pool of water, and he was so enamored with the beauty of his own reflection that he couldn't pull away from there and see the beauty or the value in anything else or anyone else, and so perished there. And hence our word, narcissism. For the last several years, I go to a professional conference in Europe or somewhere abroad, usually in Europe, almost every summer. And in recent years, my wife and I have gone together to try to travel a little before and after that, piggybacking onto that trip. And one of the interesting things we've experienced in traveling around Europe is that each year a new little product is sold by street vendors that's really popular. In whatever city you go to, they have that same little thing. And it varies from one year to the next. So one year it's a little thing you put in your mouth, and then when you talk it makes a squeaky sound and it's really cool, and you see that, and then we have made this little game. We come back to the States and try to predict how many weeks it's going to be before we see it show up in CVS or in Toys R Us or in other places, and it's usually pretty quick. Another year it was a little blob of stuff, looked like a ball, but you throw it down real hard on the pavement and it just splattered. But after a few seconds, it began to contract and work back together, and in about 15 seconds, it was just a little ball again. A really neat little thing. I mean, I didn't buy it. I wouldn't buy anything like that. Sure enough, we saw it a few weeks later in stores here. But anyway, my point is that one year, and this was about, I guess, two summers ago, we started seeing, and every little street vendor had them. People just had them and selling them, and you negotiate as you usually do on prices in Europe. We didn't know what it was at first. It looked like a little umbrella, but we knew it wasn't that. It was metallic, and it was too skinny to be an umbrella and a little bit longer. And then we noticed that they would also, if you pull it out, it was a telescope thing that you pulled it out and made a rod about this long. And then we also noticed that it had little wishbone-shaped crooks on the end, and it didn't take us long to discover that it's what we now call a selfie stick. And then we saw them not only for sale, but we saw all kinds of people using them all over Europe, and we commented on it because we saw them all over the place. And my wife said, "What do you call those things?" And I didn't know what to call them either. We learned the title only later after coming back to the States. But we had to call him something because we referred to him all the time. So I started referring to it as an instrument of narcissism. I mean, and it just you know, it amused her, and I guess probably annoyed her that I kept using that term so much. Because, you know, people used to go to the great cathedral in Milan or the Colosseum in Rome or something to take a picture of that item. But now you go to get a picture of yourself in front of that particular thing. I'm aware that a selfie stick, and sure enough, we got back to the States and they were all over within a few weeks and now are all over the place. I don't own one yet, and I won't because I still think it's an instrument of narcissism. But I am aware that there may be legitimate uses of that are not quite so narcissistic. I can't think of one right now, but I'm sure there are some. And I also am aware that even pride in not doing that can become rather narcissistic. I did manage to get in a comment that we travel in Europe quite a bit, and you know, so I understand those things. But to me, it is still first and foremost an instrument of narcissism, not only because of the item itself, but and just the term selfie just really annoys me. But and not only because of the item itself, but because of other things that it is related to that are also problematic. First of all, the cell phone. I mean, I have one of those too, and it has some good uses. But a part of this usage, let's just admit, is that the world just cannot survive very long without having instant access to me. And it's also related to Facebook and other social media, which I'm not a part of. I was for a very short time, but I just couldn't stand it because I can just handle so many posts where people say, look at this picture of me. You know, here's me and my cat. Here's me, you know, brushing my teeth on a balcony or something, as if the world just can't live without seeing that. It's narcissism again, and I don't doubt that there's some wonderful things, and certainly on Facebook and other social media there are, but anyway, there you've heard my rampage about that now, selfie, and I thought about entitling this instead of the me generation, the selfie generation, because I do think it suggests something. Maybe you have other symbols of the narcissistic world in which we live, that's mine, but I think that none of us would doubt that we live in a very me-centered sort of world. And it goes back to the very Garden of Eden. I mean, it was Adam and Eve resisting the limits that God placed upon them and trying to take charge of their own lives and their own destiny that was the original sin. And this is what evoked the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill or steal or commit adultery. I mean, I'm not going to do those things unless I value myself more than I value you. And if there's something that you have that I want, whether it be your life or your body or your possessions, and I feel a right to take those, it is because I value me more than I do you. It's even behind the commandment to observe the Sabbath. If I work all the time, I can get the illusion that things really depend upon me. But if I'm commanded not to work one day a week, and I don't work one day a week, and lo and behold, the world continues to turn. The sun continues to rise. Then I have forced on me the recognition that I'm not quite so central in the larger scheme of things than I sometimes think. I'm not the be-all and end-all. And even in matters of faith, I think this eye disease is unfortunately pandemic. Someone pointed me recently to a song by a contemporary Christian artist. This particular song is now a couple of decades old, even more than that. But I want to read to you the lyrics of it, which is a parody of this kind of self, whatever you want to call it. This is by Babbie Mason, and the song is entitled Shopping List. It comes from the 80s. Maybe some of you know about it. I had not heard about it before until fairly recently. But here are the lyrics. Lord, I need to talk to you. There's so much on my heart. So many burdens make it hard, and I don't know where to start. I thank you for my family, for your mercy and your love. Now on to more important things. I'll give my magic lamp a rub. And here's the chorus. Give me this, I want that. Bless me, Lord, I pray. Grant me what I think I need to make another day. Make me wealthy, keep me healthy, fill in what I missed on my never-ending shopping list. In the second verse, Lord, you've been so good to me, how could I ask for more? But since you said to ask, I will, because what else is prayer for? The cattle on a thousand hills, they all belong to you. I don't need any cows right now, but something else will do. And the chorus again, and here's the bridge. I've made my list and checked it twice. If I get it all, it would sure be nice. I want a nice wide smile on a perfect face and a perfect hair that's going to stay in place. I want a smaller nose and a single chin and a figure like a perfect 10. And kids that never yell or scream and hips that fit in designer jeans and a brand new house and a heated pool. I could use them, Lord, as a witnessing tool. And a color TV and a VCR and Jesus plates on a brand new car. And the chorus again, give me this, I want that. Bless me, Lord, I pray. Grant me what I think I need to make another day. Make me wealthy, keep me healthy, fill in what I missed on my never-ending shopping list. My never-ending shopping list. Well, obviously that old song is very dated. I don't think wishing for a VCR is what anyone would do nowadays. Could you even buy one? What is a VCR? What is that? And a color TV, what is that? I mean, is there some other kind of, I don't even know what that means anymore. So it is dated, but it is, of course, satirical, at least I hope it is. But it does express, at least in a parody, a very popular brand of piety, and one that is explicitly religious. It's filled with God talk. It's filled with prayer talk. It's filled with worship talk, but when boiled down to its very essence, it is a religion that is all about me. There's a popular, there's a whole industry out there, and you of course know this, in Christian guise that assures people of wealth and power if they learn how to pray the right prayers. There are popular books and seminars and speakers and webinars and that guarantee that you'll be wealthy and powerful if you pray the right prayers, if you follow the right devotional disciplines, and there are all kinds of problems with that popular brand of piety. But one of the problems is that it makes me the center and it makes God the servant. God doesn't rule in me. He serves me. He doesn't transform me. He benefits me. God is not my sovereign Lord. He's the magic lamp that I rub to get stuff. Now, other people may be blessed through my good fortune, and that's great. But fundamentally, it's all about me. I bow down before the altar of self. And those in the church, even church leaders, are not immune to this eye disease. Ministers are not. Ministers are, I think, especially susceptible to the allure of the center stage. Preachers get a lot of stroking, a lot of positive reinforcement, a lot of esteem, even a cult following in some cases. And that can be quite appealing. And some churches, large churches, have grown up around a single dynamic personality, a charismatic leader, to the point that if that person is no longer around, the church struggles to survive at all. And some leaders in that situation have confessed after the fact that they liked it that way, that they thrived on the attention, that they coveted the power trip, that they enjoyed being indispensable, planned it that way. There's a character, a little known character in the little letter of 3 John, 3 John verse 9, about whom we don't know anything except his name, Diotrephes, and his brief description that he loved to be first. We don't know anything more, but that little bit says a lot. He loved to be first, or other translations say he loved the preeminence, or he loved to be head of everything, or he loved to be number one. He liked to put himself first. Diotrephes, to go back to the metaphor from Mark of blindness, Diotrephes was not blind, but his vision was at least blurry. With his exaggerated sense of self-importance, people, again in the metaphor of Mark, must have looked like trees walking around. he had hardly denied himself in the way that Jesus calls his followers to do. And James says in James 3:16 that where there is envy and selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil practice, so that we aren't just talking about individual discipleship here, but we're talking about a detriment to the life of the community of faith. That same self-centeredness creeps into our religious discourse all too often, and sometimes in subtle ways. I think I've heard it in some conversations that I've happened to overhear among people, usually a couple, who are moving to a new place and looking for a church home. And too often the conversation goes just like it would go about how we decide on a new cell phone service, or how we select a new fitness gym, or some other service or agency. That is, what's the best one where I can get the most goods and services, the most bang for the buck? Not what church can I go to and best serve and best plug in and best use my talents and opportunities and build the kingdom of God, but rather what goods and services does it offer for my convenience and enjoyment, as if it's all about me. I think I hear it sometimes in discussions, contemporary discussions about the worship experience, as we sometimes call it. Worship is, of course, a powerful experience, and it should be, should have a powerful impact on the worshiper. But sometimes I'm afraid that our language betrays something that we don't really mean to. If instead of talking about worship, which is God-focused and God-centered, if instead of that we spend too much time talking about the worship experience, which is focused on us and how it affects me, how it makes me feel, what it does for me, then I think I'm too much at the center of things. My vision of Jesus and his call to discipleship is distorted. People look like trees walking around. But now, is it fair to compare us, worshiping Christian believers, to these bumbling, blundering disciples in the Gospel of Mark? We are, after all, worshipful, worshiping believers. But in Mark chapter 9, the disciples worshipped too. And what worship it was on that Mount of Transfiguration. They had an amazing glimpse of Christ in his glory, more amazing than any sight in Malibu, California. But being awestruck in the presence of God and worshipful isn't the same thing as listening. And so the heavenly voice says to them, listen to him. They had worshipped, but they didn't listen. And they evidenced the fact that they hadn't listened fully to his call of discipleship, because when they come down from the mountain, not only are they competitive with each other about which one is the greatest, but they show exclusivism toward others who are acting in Jesus' name. Their sight was still impaired. Our most fervent worship, as good as it is, as important as it is not a guarantee that our discipleship is what it should be. But we have confessed Christ, and we wear the name of Christ. Yes, but Peter, in our text, confessed Christ as well. And correctly confessed Christ, boldly confessed Christ. And yet it was immediately after that Jesus said to him, "Get away from me, Satan," because he had tried to squeeze Christ into his own mold rather than confessing him on his own terms. Confessing Christ doesn't mean that one is a true follower of Christ who has denied self. But I've been on a spiritual retreat, or I've been to the Pepperdine lectures. Well, yeah, but you know, Jesus' disciples went on a retreat, many retreats in the Gospel of Mark. What a retreat it must have been. Mark 6:31, Jesus says, "Come away to a deserted place by yourselves and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves." What a retreat that must have been. And their speaker was not N.T. Wright or somebody like that. It was Jesus himself. Marvelous retreat. But they were fuzzy and unclear on the extent of the call to follow him and deny self. But I'm involved in service projects and in actions for social justice. Good, but so were the disciples in Mark. According to chapter 3, they protected Jesus from the crowds. According to chapter 4, they provided a boat for him. According to chapter 6, they distributed food to thousands of people. Again, in chapter 8, distributed food to thousands of people. In chapter 11, they arranged transportation for Jesus into Jerusalem. Chapter 14, they prepared the Passover. According to chapter 6, they anointed many sick people with oil and cured them. And they served in many other ways. These disciples were busy with activity, good activity, religious activity. But they hadn't heard fully the call to discipleship or hadn't processed it. But I've been on a mission trip. Well, these disciples had been out two by two, according to chapter 6, preaching the same message that Jesus preached, without money, without food, without extra provisions. But all the while in the dark about true discipleship. Hardly a thing could be said about these about us that couldn't be said of these 12. Peter even said, "Look, Lord, we've left everything and followed you." And he had. They had. They had left everything. Homes and families and occupations to follow Jesus. Follow him through the storms and the controversies and through want. And yet they were far from Jesus' ideal of discipleship. Their vision of true discipleship was distorted at best. Their vision was impaired. It was as if people looked to them like trees walking around. That was the extent of their clarity of vision. And so if they needed corrective vision, then surely we do too. And Jesus' message to those who would follow him today is basically the same as it was to the 12. Deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. It's not likely that any one of us will have to take up a cross in any literal sense and die for our faith. Although, frankly, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that many, many people in our world do exactly that. In the 20th century and in this young 21st century, there are far more people who are persecuted for their faith and who die daily for their faith than in those centuries that we regard as centuries in which Christianity was persecuted. Far more people, many times more people. And whether or not we face martyrdom, being a disciple of Jesus does call for self-denial and does and always has cut against the grain of culture and is costly. Not costly in the light and flippant way that we usually use it. The little coffee kiosk out by our fountain, well, it's not a fountain now because we've turned the water off during California's water crisis, but what we used to call the fountain, the little kiosk out there, coffee, it didn't have its espresso machine working today and yesterday. Maybe it got back going again today. So some people had to do without their shot, yesterday and today. But we all have a cross to bear. For Lent this year, I'm going to give up Brussels sprouts for 40 days. Well, I really don't eat green things anyway. How lightly and flippantly we talk about self-sacrifice and cross-bearing. True discipleship entails and has always entailed self-denial and costly self-denial. Of all the idols that compete for our devotion, that preclude God's rule, by far the most powerful one and the most effective one is the self. And that's surely why in the same breath that Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, and in fact right before that he says, deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. Martyrdom is not the essence of discipleship, although martyrdom may be involved. Giving up things is not the essence of discipleship, although that is certainly involved, sometimes, usually. Giving up all sense of self and self-worth and dignity, self-dignity and individuality is not the essence of discipleship. Discipleship, first and foremost, is the dethroning of self as the be-all and end-all in order to make room for God's rule. And the great paradox of it is, and the good news of the gospel is, that it is in denying ourselves that we find ourselves. Jesus said, "For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it." Losers are keepers. C.S. Lewis said this in Mere Christianity: Christ says, "Give me your all. I don't want so much of your time or money or work. I want you. No half measures are good enough. Hand over the whole self. All the desires which you think innocent as well as the ones you think wicked. The whole outfit. And I will give you a new self instead." Have you ever wondered why pigeons walk the way they do? My oldest son asked me that one time when he was a little boy, and he could tell I didn't have an answer, so he made it a point to ask me that fairly regularly every time we saw a pigeon. And by that I mean, why do they bob their heads back and forth every step as they walk? Why can't they just walk, he asked me one day, like regular people. I read a few years ago, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that the reason they do that is because they can't focus their eyes when their heads are moving. And so they have to bring their head to a complete stop before each step. As the body continues to move forward, the head has to stop in order for the eyes to focus, for them to focus and not fall as they walk. Again, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I wouldn't even know how to find out whether that's true or not. I mean, I don't think interviewing, you know, a bunch of pigeons is very constructive. But I do know this, that in our spiritual lives, we are in such constant motion that we would do well to stop occasionally, maybe stop fairly often, to refocus. One way to do that I want to suggest, a very practical way, is to read through the Gospel of Mark in one sitting. You can do that in a couple of hours, 2.5 hours, even if you're a fairly slow reader. Paying attention, of course, to the way Jesus is portrayed, but also observing the disciples, their blind spots, their myopic vision, their short-sightedness, their other forms of visual impairment, as a way of discerning our own and correcting our own. Now, that's not a quick fix, because self-denial is a process. It's not a one-time thing at all. We haven't looked at the second story in Mark of the healing of a blind person. It's the story of blind Bartimaeus at the end of chapter 10. The man who was healed at bringing closure to that section is that second bookend holding this larger block of material together. And it says that his sight was restored, and after it he followed Jesus on the way. Followed him on the way, which is Mark's language, meaning the way of the cross, the way of discipleship. It is a way, it is a journey, it is a process, it's a path, rather than something that happens instantaneously. But it is a process that will never even begin without an intentional denial of the primacy of self and the embracing of God's kingdom, God's rule. So here, once again, these lines from Jesus for all who would follow him then or now. Mark 8:34. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. 9:35. Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. 10:42 and following. Among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. I'll stop there. I suppose maybe I was misleading in giving as a title that I did. Maybe I implied that I had some wisdom to offer in how we call people to self-denial in a me-oriented world, and I don't know how to do that. But I do know that we need to continue to issue the call and not water it down, but call people to self-denial, because that is integral to the call to discipleship. And I don't know how to do that. I have no wisdom to offer on that, except to say that, of course, we need to model it ourselves, first and foremost. Well, I'll stop there, and we have just a few minutes for questions that you might have or comments, so let me open it up for you to do that, please. Yes.
Do you think that self-denial, while we still feel our way, is something that we can actually fully accomplish? Or
well, probably not, because we're human beings, and yet it is something toward which we must strive, and I think something toward which we must constantly strive, and it is a process, it is a way, it is a path, but it is a path that we will never get very far on at all if we just excuse ourselves by saying we can't achieve it fully. And so somewhere between expecting perfection of ourselves and others to whom we minister and just writing it off and saying we can't be perfect, so why try? Somewhere between those extremes is a call to discipleship and self-denial that we need to take very, very seriously if we take Jesus' call to take up a cross and deny self seriously. Uh-huh.
Okay. What about, how do we link people up to the fact of their poor vision?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it seems to me that part of what Jesus was doing through this whole section was trying to get them, you know, I mean, healing the blind man in the beginning, you know, to bring in vision, but he's not, in one sense, he's not laying his hands on the disciples and saying, you know, yeah, wake up, or, you know, that type of thing. But how do we go about working with people to help them kind of see in a society that's so myopic?
Yeah, that's the big question, and I don't have a neat answer for that. First of all, I think it's most important that we model that, and maybe this is the most important thing, we also need to keep before people the vision of the one who did give himself and who served others rather than attempting to be served, and who gave of himself, who went to the cross. And we need to hold that before people and present before people to whom we minister the call of the gospel in all of that fullness, and not water it down and make it sound as if it's not costly, that it's all easy. Beyond that, and of course modeling it ourselves, I'm not sure, because it is countercultural. I mean, it is just countercultural. And I suspect it always has been and always will be. But it seems to me that it is especially problematic in our very me-centered world. And I don't have any wisdom on how to do that beyond that, modeling it ourselves, but most especially holding before people the model of Jesus and the writings of Paul and his call to radical obedience, and just refusing on principle to water that down and soften it. Uh-huh.
There was a story I heard a number of years ago, and I don't have time to share it, but the end item of the story was a single statement: I am third, God is first, then there's everybody else, and there's me.
Yeah.
And Christ is the embodiment of that. First there was God, then there was everybody else, and there was me.
Yeah. And, of course, that's very countercultural. The gospel itself, every core element of the gospel is countercultural.
Yes.
And we might as well admit that, although I think we can also hold before people whom we try to influence the recognition that it is in self-sacrifice, giving up of self, that we find self. And the challenge, of course, is to communicate that, because everything in our culture tells us to be self-assertive and to be self-centered, and it's a subtle message, and usually, frankly, not so subtle. And it is an uphill battle, but it is a battle that is part and parcel of Christian life, and of course, of Christian ministry.
Mm-hmm. And even despite its countercultural message, it is the lives of a Mother Teresa,
yeah,
or a Martin Luther King, or that